Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 940. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. So, you may have heard the future is coming, and don't be surprised by it. You need to make your life brighter with Squarespace. Turn your cool idea into a new website, showcase your work, blog, or publish your content. Sell your stuff online. Sell your services online, as long as they're legal. Announce an upcoming event or a special project. You're going to get beautiful templates created by world-class designers, incredibly powerful e-commerce functionality where you can sell anything, and the ability to customize the look and the feel and the settings, products, anything with just a few clicks. It's all optimized for mobile right out of the box. And you can buy domains as well. You choose from over 200 extensions. So everything that you need is really right there at Squarespace. Built-in SEO, free and secure hosting, 24/7 award-winning customer support. Check out squarespace.com for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use the offer code ID10T to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Thank you to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the ID10T podcast. Let's go over to the community corkboard. What do you think about that, Lids?
Don't just shake your head at me.
Say a thing.
I wasn't listening to what you were saying.
Oh, nice. So this is marriage. What are we, a year and a half in and already?
I'm sorry. I have no idea what you're talking about.
I'm doing a fucking podcast intro.
No, I got that part kind of, but... I was trying to give you your privacy.
I'm literally lying right next to you in bed. How is that? How are you giving me privacy?
I don't know.
So just by ignoring me?
I zoned out. I was being respectful.
Thank you for your respectful zoning. Oh, for Christ. Oh, my God.
I love you.
I love you too. I guess that's what happens after 18 months, whatever it is.
Well, I was trying not to talk to you, so I won't interrupt your intro.
All right, well, thank you. It's very kind. Anyway, you can go to the corkboard, which is corkboard at id10t.com. Cade Barrett, the corkboard is the thing where people write in about their things that they're doing, and then
it's not like that old school thing people had in their kitchens that you tack stuff onto.
Yeah, it's like that, but boy, you're really cracking yourself up. She did the space work for it and everything, like pinned the thing into the walls. All right. Cade Baird says, you told me to make a thing, I made a thing. Turned out to be a children's book. I wrote a book about an immigrant boy who was being bullied, had a brilliant Australian artist hand-paint the illustrations, and then self-published it. It's a story that helps children who are being bullied get grown-ups involved, and hopefully will help kids who may be prone to bullying have more empathy. On top of that, I'm donating 50% of the profits to two different charities. 25% will go to a charity that benefits refugees. 25% will go to a charity that institutes emotional and social learning programs into schools that help prevent bullying and improve academic performance. I put over $3,000 of my own money into the project, so I need to sell quite a few books before I can start making donations to these organizations. The book is called Rafa and the Mist. Bullies chase Rafa into a forest where he meets a mist who gives him valuable insight on how to deal with difficult problems. Available internationally via Amazon and ebook on most services like iTunes, Nook, and Kindle, and in hardcover online from Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can learn more at rafaandthemist.com or at rafaandthemist on Instagram. Michael Curley writes, I've always been passionate about watching and analyzing films. Last year, I finally put myself out there and started publishing film essays. Currently going through the Marvel films one at a time, starting with Blade. All of our strengths, none of our weaknesses. The most recent article was on Elektra and Fantastic Four is coming up. I try to write from a place of love and passion for the films rather than a place of negativity, so that so many film writers seem to think is necessary. Agreed, Michael Curry. The articles are hosted at popmatters.com, a fantastic independent pop culture website featuring thoughtful long-form articles. You can also find me on Twitter at m_curlyfries with an E in curly. Well done. This episode is it's like a group of people. All right. So it's like churches and the National. Well, it's not like it actually is. It's Lauren Mayberry and Martin Doherty of Churches and Matt Berninger of the National, who did a song together called My Enemy. Matt featured on this Churches single, and it's great. It's like they were really able to take both of their styles and perfectly layer them together. And this is from Church's upcoming album, Love is Dead, which will be released in May and is available for pre-order now. So, yeah, this is actually Matt and Lauren are returning to the podcast. We did them separately, Lauren in 2014 and Matt in 2013. So, and then Martin's brand new to the podcast. So there you go. That is this episode, which is also brought to you by Beachbody On Demand, which is an online fitness streaming service that gives you unlimited access to an incredible variety of very effective world-class workouts personalized to meet your needs. Again, I've said this before, I have subscribed to this for a long time, and it is a fantastic resource, especially if you're on the road and you want to get some workouts in. They have really quick ones, they have longer form ones, they have really intense ones, they have yoga classes, there's nutrition. It's the total package to help you become your best self this year. Now, if you can't afford a gym or you can't afford a trainer, then you don't need any of that stuff with this subscription. It's convenient, accessible via computer, web-enabled TV, tablet, smartphone. It's for any fitness level. Workouts range from cardio to weight training. Like I said, yoga, low impact, even dance. Over 600 workouts. So check it out right now. ID10T listeners can get a free trial membership when you text ID10T to 303030. And you're going to get full access to the entire platform for free. All the workouts and nutrition information for free as well. Just text ID10T to 303030. That is Beachbody On Demand. Also, stamps.com, the easiest way to get all the amazing services of the post office. Any letter package, use your computer, printer, mail carrier picks it up. Everything from postcards to envelopes to packages, domestic or international. Create your stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. Click print, mail, you're done. They're going to send you a digital scale. You're going to automatically calculate the exact postage you need. And they're even going to help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. Anything you can do at the post office, you can do from your desk with Stamps.com. Right now, you can also enjoy Stamps.com with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Don't worry about leaving your house for any reason, even to mail a letter. Use stamps.com. Go to stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in ID10T. That is stamps.com. Enter the promo code ID10T. I'd like to thank Stamps for continuing to support the podcast, even after the name change. And now this is the ID10T podcast number 940 with Churches and Matt Berninger.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
And you're listening to Jed the Fish on Is Jed the Fish still working here, Rick?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I haven't listened to actual radio in so long.
Terrestrial?
It's Sirius. Sirius XMU.
That's where
That's
we were.
Where we were this
you were at Sirius XMU.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't they like us better. Like so we don't have to be like please. So yeah.
It's a good station.
I think there'll be a lot of K-Rock begging. Because we always beg them and they're always like
Really?
You only have to beg all the radio stations. That's like a weird thing.
They're terrible. They got a lot of Papa Roach to play.
They're like, I'm not sure if we want to get this, like, 20-year-old Foo Fighter song off the radio for any of the music.
Yeah, we could play Churches, or we could play that acoustic version of Everlong again.
Right? That is good.
That one's really good one, though.
I got a bunch of horrific car accent to that song, so I have to change it every time it's on.
That's true. I didn't know that.
Yeah, going to 110 to the 405 and rolled my truck.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It was okay. It was 2001.
So when that song should have been on the radio.
Yes, yeah, exactly. now it's just like they're taunting me with it.
Well, but then we went to the Almost Acoustic Christmas K-Rock thing when we were here in December, and I was looking at the lineup, I was like, yep, I can see why we don't get played on the radio.
Yeah.
Oh, it's mostly... I worked at K-Rock from 95 to 98, and they play a lot of stuff that was there when I was there. So it's almost become like an alternative oldie station in a weird sort of way.
Yeah. And it's Southern California, too, so it's tons of Sublime, and they'll play that one Pennywise. It's like a lot. It's just terrible. It's, then they'll play like drummer. Occasionally they'll play a good song from when they played good music.
I got really upset because about 2 years ago, I happened to listen to, I stumbled across K-Earth 101, and K-Earth 101 was the LA station that, when I was in high school, played like 50s music and 60s music, and they're playing fucking Nirvana.
No.
And I just was like,
time-wise it works out.
It does work out. Time-wise it does work out. 25 years.
Oh, I didn't like that at all.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that shitty?
When I see like a high school kid wearing like a Nirvana shirt or something like that, I go, oh yeah, that would be the kid wearing the Led Zeppelin shirt when I went to high school.
Right.
Same kind of kid.
Yeah. That kid's parents were kids when.
There's a great line in Clueless where it's Breckin Meyer's character goes like, The way my parents feel about Nine Inch Nails is the same way I feel about like Rolling Stones. So I should stop giving my the way my kids are going to feel about Nine Inch Nails is the same way I feel about Rolling Stones. So I should give my parents less of a hard time. He's like, sure,
That's how it goes. That's how it goes. But now all the kids now are going to be like, they're going to be listening to Churches for the rest of their lives.
Not if we don't get on K-Rock, but then I'm like, well, I don't know, like, how many... Because it was interesting to go...
You know we get played on K-Rock, right?
Yeah, but they don't... They're always like, maybe you can play the show. No, you can't.
I'm not 100% sure. I mean, does radio really... Is it really that influential any longer?
Not for us to say. It's for them.
We don't know either.
Like,
knocking it down regionally was really helpful for us in the beginning.
Yeah.
But it's hard. Streaming is so huge now that it's like two avenues that are splitting off from each other.
And it's not like you can go do an interview at Spotify, right? I mean, there's not really a...
Well, it's interesting. We saw the guys from Death Cab were recording their record here, so we saw them yesterday. And it was interesting to hear them say that they were at certain shows now when they play big radio shows. They're like, people at those shows freak out about the songs from the last most recent record, which... And then he said it, and he was like, which older fans are like, these aren't like Quintessential Death Cab, these aren't the big songs. But then people lose their minds on them because Atlantic caught it on the radio.
The radio songs.
I might run to the bathroom.
I was in Reno with Harmar. We were shooting. But it's like, but then me and Harmar were in the car, and then Dawes came on the radio. And it was so weirded out because Dawes always seemed like an LA band that people in LA knew.
Yeah.
But then they were playing on the radio, and then after the song played, they said, yeah, they'll be playing some arena. Wow. And it's like, that's how regional music can be sometimes.
Band are you talking about?
Dawes? Yeah, they've been around and like they went to that school Crossroads, so they're like real rich LA kids, you know?
Yeah.
They always just kind of played around. They were part of that, like, not Maroon 5, but, you know, Rooney, like those kids. I thought it was just one of those LA bands that never really, but then they were playing some huge arena, like in, you know, rural Nevada. And it's just like a gigantic.
So their region, though, is like...
I think it's...
like L.A., Nevada, that vibe.
Yeah, I think it's like L.A. specific, because people probably saw them when they were growing up at like small shows. And then you go out and it's, you know... Like we drove by the where they were having the concert, and it was, you know, a lot of good old boys.
Yeah. Well, I have friends who don't get any radio play at all. And they just, by nature of touring on the right schedule for so many years, and because of the internet, are doing better than they have ever done.
Yeah. Well, we don't get any. We get very. Are we doing this now? Is this?
Yeah, we kind of roll into this. Yeah, we always roll into this. So yes, we are recording now. So this is all great. We could all put. Now yeah, because I hear you. I hear the National on Sirius all the time.
Yeah, Sirius now. I mean, the radio's changing so fast. I don't know. I can't follow it fast enough to know if we're doing well or not. But generally, we haven't in the arc of our. You know, 15 or whatever, 20-year thing, radio hasn't really been necessary. Not, you know, it could have been helpful, but it wasn't. It wasn't a prerequisite to like success at all. You know, we eventually found fans in little spots, and those things kind of grew organically without any radio play.
And then the internet allowed people to meet each other and the communities to grow and thrive, and then. You know, and then all of a sudden it's you're well, like 15 years ago, I guess it was email lists. People had, you know, you'd have an email list
or zines,
but now it just seems like, oh, people just collect on the internet and find each other and they, oh, I'm a fan of, oh, you're a fan, okay, great. And then they,
well, wasn't that the whole crazy thing that happened with Arctic Monkeys? Is that like they were the first big, like it was MySpace, and like, you know, there's like a bunch of, they've just, people, someone realizes like these guys have a lot of fans on this social networking site, and then they got signed and, you know, continued to have a career. But it was like I don't think they were signed before they became huge on MySpace.
When I started at MTV, it was 1994, and Dave Matthews had just broken.
Ian's spot? I just realized.
Are we what?
Where's Ian? Where am I supposed to go?
I don't think Ian's. I think it's just the three of you.
Oh.
He's just going to creepily poke around see what he can find.
Ian's going to poke in from time to time. We don't...
dressed as various dead animals.
So here, go close your eyes.
Are you a timber wolf?
Do you have any human taxidermy here?
There's not that we can show anyone.
How much is like a piece from the Body World exhibit, Chris? Have you looked it up?
Yeah, the plastic. Well, I'm going to show you all the Disney stuff downstairs too, because we have all sorts of crazy... There's this weird commingling of Disney collectible stuff and horror stuff. Uh-huh. So you'll see like a really fun, cheery Disney thing, and then like, you know, The Exorcist.
Yeah,
like something from The Exorcist. So it's a fun. I don't know. We're fucking weird. We just like what we like. I don't know. I mean, are any of you in one city long enough to stop and collect anything? Because then you would never be able to really appreciate it.
The hardest thing is in traveling around all the time. So you always have to be mindful of how much stuff you have on you at any one given moment.
Yep.
So I don't get any collectibles really. It's like, because I'm always thinking, God, how am I going to put that in my bag? How am I going to fit all my clothes in? How am I going to fit my entire life on the road? And this giant item that I've just bought. So never buy anything when I'm traveling.
Lauren Mayberry, must-haves for a tour bus.
Must-haves for a tour bus. I sort of have a lot of really boring health stuff. I wish I could say more fun things, but I'm like, okay, like a throat steamer, humidifier. I keep a lavender oil in the little pocket in the bunk. There's a lot of terrible farts on there. I'm not going to say that they're male farts because you can't gender a fart, but
don't. A male
fart. I've definitely woken up at certain points in the evening and been like, oh, and then you just kind of put on the lavender mustache and it's all
and
right.
it's all good. By the way, you can't gender a fart is a great album name,
right?
Just if you guys want to use that for anything,
a song, it's a ballad, of course.
How many people are on a bus with you? You guys are generally when you
I think we're quite full now. It's like
it's a 12
so
it's rough.
Gone are the days of the junk bunk where you ever be like, oh, I'll put my jacket in there. No, there's a person in there that's probably going to be producing some horrendous farts or something.
What's funny about that is that you start monitoring what other people are eating, like, don't eat that. Because we have to be on the same to put down that fucking bratwurst chili dog.
Where was it? There was a day we were going from, I think, San Francisco to Arizona, maybe. And Ian and Martin were like, oh, we'll pay and we'll get a flight and then we can have a day off there. And I was like, oh, whatever, I'll stay on the bus. I can watch some TV, that'll be nice. But then the bus broke down like 2 hours outside San Francisco and then we had to live in the bus for like 2 days.
What?
And there was definitely a point where I could identify which road member who no longer worked with us, not for this reason, but then I was like, I know specifically he would only eat like pepperoni pizza and beer, and then I was like, this is such a toxic such toxicity. I was like, it must, it's the pepperoni beer fart. And I was
like, you just gotta mix it up.
Was he a rookie? Was he like, was he,
no, he was like hard. I think that's why he was like, I'll eat what I want and I'll drink everything I can put in my body. And I woke up in the nighttime, I had to open the doors on the ends of the bunks and like try and aerate it. Like, and our tour manager woke up and stuck her head out and was like, what's happening? I was like, I don't know.
Yeah, if it's you're awful. Basically creating a biodome, like if there's like a, if you're creating your own fart weather, it's just, it feels like it's bad. I've only done one bus tour and it was just my wife and I, and I.
So you knew who the farts were? Right, right.
Yes, they were mine. No, I still don't fart in front of my wife. Can't do it. Can't do it. Can't fart in front of other people. Can't
never
do it.
Seen each other naked.
That's, yeah, I know. It's, we just, you know, we're going to make the pact at some point.
We're still Disney. They haven't gotten a horror.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, but even just the two of us on a bus, it just felt like, oh, this is a really cramped, but then not realizing like, oh, yeah, there's like, you guys fit like 8 people on a bus, right? There's 6 bunks.
There's 12.
12?
Oh. And then often in the UK, it's often dodgier, I think, I find.
Yeah.
Where it's often, especially if you're doing overnighters, you have like 12 people plus 2 drivers that shift on and off, and the drivers sleep underneath sort of in a weird compartment.
That to me is like always the creepiest thing.
Like American buses, there's like the driver has a hotel room, there's no space. But in these European buses, there's a strange little cupboard.
Oh.
And then the drivers sleep in this little cupboard.
It's like a troll.
Where they just collect toenails
and the wheel. It's I mean,
eyelashes.
It seems
bus
really
drivers
cool.
have are, the good ones are angels, the bad ones are terrifying. And, and so I really respect the whatever, finding good bus drivers in a good bus company is a really lucky thing. It's, and it's really important. But it is, there are things like no matter how, where you are, it's still 10 or 12 people living on a bus. There's nothing. Mm. There's almost no way to make it glamorous.
I mean, a tour bus really is the closest thing humans have to being packed in a suitcase, where you are being compartmentalized and sort of folded up. And then moved. Mm-hmm. And you can't really, I mean, you can get up and go sit in the common area, but the common area is, you know, is really about the size of a, you know, like a bench.
Our common area is nothing but like shoes and backpacks.
That's
just like a big closet.
Like, I think the first lesson I learned, because I guess Ian and Martin had done more touring than I had when we started this band, and our tour manager used to be in a band with those guys, so they've seen things.
Sure.
And Campbell was like, these are the rules, this is what you need to know. And then he was like, no bags on seats. And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, bags don't need seats, people need seats. And I was like, after a while, I was like, yeah, I see what he means, because it's annoying when you come into a room and it's just a wall of bags and you have to like pick up all these bags to sit down. I'm like, there's a tour rule.
And how many dates are you doing at a time? So like when you're booking out a bus, like how many dates are you on the road doing?
I mean, it can be anywhere from 3 weeks to 6 weeks. Sometimes if you're really crazy, like 8 weeks.
Oh my God.
If you're feeling really wild.
If you're like committed to driving your band into the ground, it's 8 weeks.
Because that's the thing that I think a lot of people don't necessarily take into account, and maybe they understand on some level, but don't really think about that. If they see you, and it's particularly the end of your tour, part of the magic of being a really good performer is making that 40th performance seem as fun and fresh as the first performance after you've basically been, you know, living in a porta potty for you know, for two, three months.
Is that, it's also like a bar with wheels that never closes. So imagine that into the mixer. It can be difficult at times. Like, finding a way to stay healthy in the middle of a tour of that length is really difficult. You have to build in all sorts of mechanisms. Otherwise, it's just, you come right off the rails.
Can you?
Yeah. Well, you say, how do you sleep? Sleep.
I was going to ask the same question.
I couldn't sleep on the bus.
Usually, you know, medicated.
I tried so many different things. And it didn't work.
But hit me with this pipe. Knock me out.
There was a lot of like, you know what? I'll try tonight. I'll try and drink as much as I can. And right before I'm about to pass out, I go to the bunk, and I'd crawl to my bunk. I'd slip in, and then right when I put my head on the pillow, my eyes are just wide. And we had a driver that we thought we were going to get a driver called Smooth K. Everyone called him Smooth Kenny. And it's like his whole legend is like, he's never hit a rumble strip. Smooth Kenny's great. You're going to love Smooth Kenny. And then like every single night, like I'm above the wheel well, and it's just like, ka-chung, ka-chung, ka-chung. Like every, and I was
that
like,
was the night Smooth Kenny broke.
That was, I thought, I was like, hey, what's up with this? I thought we got, I can, I, Smooth Kenny. Kenny is a fucking, and I was like, oh, we don't got Kenny. We ended up getting Daryl. And I was like, fucking bumping
be Daryl, man.
Well, now terrible. Also too, because you know the bus drivers are not—they're a tight, they're a small community of guys that do this. So you guys and ladies, I assume, and so you kind of have to be on good behavior too, because as much as you're, I imagine, judging their performance, they're going, this band sucks, don't tour with this band, or these guys are cool, or that lady's not nice, or this man's a jerk, or they're okay.
I think that. Like, I have a long list of, like, oh, man, I'm like, who'd ever want to be a tour manager? What a thankless job. Who'd ever want to be a band manager? What a thankless job. You know, I'm like, bands are kind of dicks, I'm sure, a lot of the time. So I think I'm so sorry. Yeah. Just apologizing.
We always try and be nice. Although we did have that one bus driver that was a felon and didn't tell us.
Yeah,
and
we got trapped.
We just drove to Canada.
Yeah.
And we had a show like that night. And he didn't let him in. We were stranded at the Canadian border.
Yeah, and all the gear's in the bus. We were in the bus. The support van was in the bus. So in the end, we had to get... I think... Was it Vancouver?
It was Vancouver.
So at least it was close enough to the border. And we had to, like, phone the venue and get, like,
that's
a bunch
a
of, like...
That's kind of crazy.
That right?
Taxis. Yeah, yeah. And then the guy was like, I don't know anything. And then after a while... He just had not disclosed to employer that he'd had some indiscretions.
That would, you know, make it difficult to get across the Canadian border.
But we made it.
We got
to
cabs.
The venue at like 9 p.m. And then we just like threw the support. We were like, go, get up. But we did it. But yeah. It was pretty... And I think our poor tour manager had a terrible day because then she had to find hotel rooms for like this many people at 1 in the morning in Vancouver.
But it must have been nice that you got your own hotel room for like one night.
For like 4 hours before we had to go back to the border and try and like unimpound the bus.
I mean, that is all the, you know, when you're young and you're like, I want to be a musician, and I can't wait to share my art with the world. It's just all the little logistical things. You go, oh, that's a pain. Oh, I didn't realize you'd have to do that. Oh, okay. It's just like, it seems like you spend most of your life trying to support that, you know, 1 hour you're on stage. Mm. And how are you, you know, like, how do you maintain and how do you protect just that 1 hour where you have to be just on, especially when you don't feel like it or when you're, you know, or if there's anything you're sick of playing, you still gotta go out there.
And of course, when you finally get used to it is when the cycle flips and you go back to the studio and you don't see anyone for a year. Mm-hmm. And you get completely out of the way of it. You're so out of practice. You're making records, so you don't talk to anyone. And then one day, you're about thrown back into the world again. And you have to build all that resistance again. It is tough, but, I mean, it's not like...
We're not down to mine.
Yeah,
I mean, it's all right, guys.
I'm all right with it. But it's hard.
If it starts to catch, I mean, if you start to get successful and people start paying attention, you start to have you have to chase it. And touring is how bands find audiences, and being a good tour band, a good live band is, you don't have to, but you don't have to have a lot of radio to be able to find it. And these guys are a great live band. All that's a whole package. So once people start paying attention, you realize how lucky you are. So you just keep running faster.
Right.
Because no one gets as close as you get, and so you're not going to let it get away from you. And but then after years, those years start to stack up, and you get weird, and you have to force yourself just to pull the plug at some point and reconnect to the world and you know, family and all that kind of stuff. It's very dangerous if you don't just like slow down.
So. Yeah, but it's like what you're saying is like you're trying. So, and I think this spills over into other areas, other forms of performance too, where you got to chase, and then even if you can unplug, you sort of feel like, no, I can't break the momentum. I'll never get it back. It took me years to build up that momentum. What do I, you know, what if I step away and then I got to start all over again?
Yeah. That's one of the greatest challenges, is finding the strength to say stop when it gets to that point.
Plus, sometimes I think you just got to give it a minute. Like, I feel like sometimes, especially with bands and stuff, like we did 2 albums 2 years apart, and I was like, maybe everyone just needs a little break from us. Like, you know, I was like, there hadn't been a summer that had gone by where people weren't like, we weren't in people's faces. So I think it was probably good to take a break to let people.
There's different channels. There's a lot of artists that it's like, I'm just learning this. We're a band that just goes away for a few years, and the first year, you know, we don't talk to each other for a while because we just lived on a bus together for 2 years before that. And then year two, we start to really dig in. Year three, we're hot at it, and then year four, we're chasing as fast as we can, and the record comes out. I mean, that's how it is now. Before it was, but it's now there are ways to just put out a song here and then put out another song here and do it slowly without in a big album format. And I think it's artists changing the form for which they, you know, do it. I think is good for that artist too, just to try different things. And a lot of our bands just like work on projects that are totally unrelated to a, you know, an indie rock band if possible, you know, and that just it breaks the ice on like where you started to like get, you know, just really walk in the same circles, and it also gives you something else to write about, you know, if you
right.
don't walk away from that crucible, that little weird indie or whatever crucible it is that the festival rock band life is, then you end up writing about that. You know, and that you can write about that well, but it's then you just you start to eat leftovers in your mind. You know,
right?
You have to go do something else and reconnect to have anything interesting to write about.
So does this mean you're announcing here on this podcast your thrash metal project?
I've done enough. Yeah, I'm done with sort of those kind of side projects and stuff. I don't need any more bands.
But it must be kind of interesting when you sort of form whatever your thing is, whatever your voice is. And I imagine this is why collaborations like what you're doing come into play, where you, because you have different chemistry with different people. Yeah. But do you ever feel painted into a corner of like, well, I really want to do this thing, but I don't know. People kind of look at me as this, and I don't know. But at the same time, I should evolve. But is that evolving too far outside what I normally do?
This is like the great question of every album. It's like, do we consolidate or do we risk what we have to take it somewhere else creatively? It's a question I think that everyone goes through, I think. But you can't answer it until you get into the process of making a record. And you have to be free enough to just write what comes into your mind in that moment. Channel what you're listening to that week or that 6 months or what you've been influenced by over the last 2 years. Rather than just being so concerned with like satisfying what you already have is the only way that I can do it. If I'm constantly thinking about the past when I'm trying to make a record for next year, for example, it never works. It never ever works because you're working within too many constraints.
Sure.
That said, you know, thrash metal is a bridge too far, you know. It's
right.
Like there's a within a much you could say really easily. Oh, it's been so interesting to listen to 100 different things this year, and that the sum of all that is X, Y, and Z musically. You never go to the extreme. There's always something particularly personal that brings you back into a certain space, you know.
Yeah,
and then the greatest artists. Some of them can just change like that.
But that's part of the agreement that they have with their audience, is that they expect them to do that
right.
all the time. But you have to really condition. I think the audience is, they'll deal with whatever is part of the agreement that you have with them. Like, I'm going to do this, or I'm only going to do this.
But you got to gain their trust.
Yes.
You know, there's that thing. There's like bands that will have a sound in their first album, and then they'll maybe do the same sound the next album, and then they start to progress. But there was, you know, there's bands too that just jump ahead because by the time they record that first album, it had been, you know, the songs they've been writing for years, and the next album was like, you know, the songs they grew up and they made these new songs. And sometimes I've, you know, seen that band people just check out. They're like, oh, they changed too much. There wasn't enough of what I liked in the first place. So basically it's a shop that changed their menu.
I mean, we naturally progress as appreciators and listeners, and therefore that impacts on what we put out as generally speaking. But that pressure to protect what you always have, what you have in the first place, never really leaves. It's always kind of somewhere in the background. Yeah. Unless you're like David Bowie or Prince or like Madonna, who would just fearlessly change overnight. Yeah.
I do think there's room for satanic churches where you just go super dark, super like thrashy, super just totally changed tonally what you guys are talking about, just for one album. Yeah. Just to see what
go
people
to Norway
say
for a year.
I read there's a film like the story of Mayhem or something that's coming out.
Oh really?
I saw that yesterday. It's going to Sundance or something, and they're doing like a fictionalized version of that somewhere. Maybe I'll just watch that.
Yeah. Not have to live it?
Not have to live that. I don't want to have to...
Once we were in Norway on Halloween, and we put on corpse paint, like black metal corpse paint, it didn't go down well at all.
Those people, they burn churches down and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
In Norway. I don't think it's as mainstream. We thought it would be a nice reference, and it was Halloween, and they would like it. And Ian's really a great artist, so he does really intricate paint. And we were like, it's beautiful. And then we went, and nobody else was dressed up, and everyone was just looking at us like we were idiots. So we're not necessarily big in Norway.
Are you sure they were looking at you like you're idiots, or were they like, I wish I had thought of that?
So cool.
Maybe you're misreading. Maybe Norwegian satisfaction looks like Norwegian disappointment to your Scottish eyes.
Maybe.
It's possible.
That's a really nice way of spinning
it. You know, maybe it's a great way. By the way, I had so much fun doing the benefit show that you put on in Los Angeles. That was a great show. That was just a top to bottom great show.
We pulled it off. I was a bit worried. Like the day before, I was like, there's so much stuff to do. But yes, our manager, our production manager, were very organized. In a way that I am just not so.
The room was full. The Fonda Theater. I saw my friend Mike Furman and I performed. Pete Holmes was there. Cameron and Rio were there. And then you had Ben Gibbard performed, and you performed, and some other really great bands that I wasn't as familiar with that were all fantastic.
It was a gig. Turned out it was a good night. It made money literally for the kids. So yep. It was nice. It was good. We hadn't played a show in a long time.
Weird. That was the first time either of us had appeared in public for like a year.
appeared in public.
You know, I was nervous because, like I said, the binary nature of what a musician does. That was it. That was the first time back. I'm back in the backstage, like shaking, like it's the first time I've ever been on stage.
Did they remember you when you? Everyone remembered you when you came out, right?
Right, they were like, "Who's that guy?" He's like the other guy. He's like the guy, but fatter.
Well, and normally, like I guess maybe you guys find this. I'm like, we stress out about different things, and I think I panic. Not so much now, but I used to panic a lot about live shows. And you and Ian are like the steady hands. You don't really panic about those things. And then I was like, I'm quite nervous about this. And then I was like, I'll look at Martin. It's like the kind of like the airline crew. If they're not panicked, then everything's fine. But if they're running down the aisle, then it's bad. And I kind of looked around and I was like, oh no, you don't look very confident about this. Oh no, it's going to be a mess.
But
it was fine, you know, whatever. Yes, three songs. I got the words wrong to our own song and not the covers, which is par for the course.
events like that, the kind of small events that are for like charities or something like that, are often really a lot of people come on, and you have sometimes speakers and then bands and stuff. Those can be the most terrifying.
Yet
you're there for all the best reasons for charity, that you just sweat bullets. I did a thing at Largo the other night, which is, and I just had to sing a couple of songs, but I was just like, I found myself shaking like I used to, but I've gotten over it. But there it was, back again, like on stage.
Well, you're also performing for like 200 people at Largo, 250 people at Largo. It's very intimate.
Yeah,
you can really see, you know, like the front row is 18 inches from the stage.
Yeah, they can hear your stomach growl. Like, in the middle of a song. That's how quiet that place is.
And with benefits, the ticket prices are more expensive, so there's more at stake.
Yeah.
You know? And it's also for charity, and it's like you want to do a good show for the kids.
Yeah. Also, a lot of people don't know who you are. Like, when you do their show,
you're not playing for your crowd.
Yeah, there's like, you know, one, you know, small percentage of the people in the room know who you are. So I think it's good to do that.
Everyone knows who the National is by this point. Don't you think I would think
16-year-old niece just went to a camp of like a nature conservancy sort of education camp, and a bunch of hip kids from all over the country, all 16-year-olds, 22 of them, and one of them had heard of our band.
Those are 16-year-olds though, so they probably like a lot of YouTube bands and like kids.
Every one of them was wearing a church's T-shirt. I'm like, I know them at least.
You're like, come on, you mentioned me enough
that one more.
One of them, get it.
Well, my uncle did a collaboration with them. Oh, really? Yeah, they did. It's coming out.
Like, did that band used to open for the Grateful Dead?
I think it's always, like, we can always kind of tell, Justin, the guy that was helping us host
Yes.
Host the Charity Man. He is an actor.
Justin Long. He's an amazing, phenomenal, nice, hilarious actor.
He's a nice man. But we can always tell from a distance whether someone's coming over to talk to him or to us. you can always tell from right far away. And I'm like, it's like a kind of like emotional looking person wearing flannel or a hoodie. I'm like, that's mine. 110%. And then anybody else, I'm like, and I've got it down now. I take three different versions of the photo and then I hand it back. I'm like, right, off you go, guys. Come on. You got what you needed. Off you go.
That's really
so
fun.
So I'm a really efficient, like, publicist for him certain times. I'm like,
you can really tell. Like, I always know if I see someone wearing a Star Wars t-shirt or like a Harry Potter pin or something, I go, that person's going to recognize me.
Yeah.
And because we're all part of the same tribe. So what is it? What is the national? Like, what, like, if someone recognizes you at a cafe or something, is there, do you know, can you go, oh, I can peg that person. I know they're going to know.
No, not anymore. I mean, there's sometimes, you know, thin, young, depressed boys, you know, are often it. But now we're seeing depressed people of all genres.
Sure, of course,
all,
yeah,
of all
yeah.
ages.
Nice. Yeah, of course.
And demographics coming after us. No. But I mean, it's been kind of funny. Like, we have fans that have been with us that have, you know, knew us way back 15 years ago, but then there are fans that are just finding out about us because of newer records and don't know anything about our older records. We're really lucky that somehow we've managed to not get too wrapped up in one little bubble or scene.
Yep.
and then kind of drifted away with that,
you know?
And we've seen so many amazing bands just kind of get packaged in a thing, and that thing isn't and they just float away with that whatever. Somehow we've snapped out of whatever particular pen we almost got into, and I don't know why. I think it's just like your thing. We talk about just when you're making stuff, don't think about what you did before. Don't think about, just try to keep yourself excited, and that's constantly what we've done. So I think people that like our band just know that we like our records. They know we're making the record that we really are excited about making right now for whatever reason. So they just trust us.
Yeah.
They know that we're not trying to feed them product, you know. Music listeners, people who really pay attention, can tell when they're being fed product or they're getting something from somebody who's like scratching itches that they haven't scratched before, you know.
Right.
There's a difference in people who listen to records over and over and kind of sink into it the way you know we all did with our records collections. They'll find you eventually. So just assume there's people just like you out there that you know. So just follow what you want.
Yeah, because I think there is some of it too. Just I think is just staying in the game and continuing to make stuff over a long, long, long period of time, and that there might be ebbs and flows. I mean, I'm sure when Kid A came out on Radiohead, like following up OK Computer, people were like, "What is what?" You know, and then they did all these kind of experimental things, but the audience stuck with them, you know, like some of the audience stuck with them. But now, you know, I just saw them at the Shrine and Radiohead at the Shrine, and it was like they were the best I've ever seen them play. And so it just seems like, oh, they needed 20 years of everything that they did and ups and downs to get to this point. So even I guess it really is,
I mean,
just kind of doing
every artist you care about. Radiohead, you know, Dylan, you know, Simone or Bowie, they all had phases where like everyone or big groups of people turned against them and hated what they were doing, you know, and that was all part of their, you know, and it's not to say that it's also, Dylan's also got a lot of really bad records, you know, I mean,
it depends on who you ask, which one's right, it's true, so does Bowie.
Bowie's not, none of these artists have flawless collections, you know?
Right.
It's like, but it's the ones that they're just looking in new places for stuff, and that's the ones you pay attention to over your lifetime, you know, not over that phase of that college, that year in college.
Well, that's also the great thing about if something comes out that doesn't connect as well, you know, if you make something else that does, people aren't going to remember the thing that didn't connect as well because it didn't connect as well. So it just sort of gets, so I mean, I still feel like I hear stuff from people that I respect. I go, when did they make that thing?
Right.
And they're like, well, it just sort of got swept under the rug.
Is that something that's only allotted to bands that get to a certain level of success where, you know, smaller bands that kind of need to keep the fans they have to keep on touring and keep on selling that many records to sustain their their level of success, which may be just what they're comfortable with or what have you. But, you know, bands that, like, I guess, for example, like, you know, Not a Surf has essentially kind of put out the same record for, you know, years and years. And that's, and it's a good record. That record they keep on making is very good. But it's like, if they got bigger and they had, you know, more time or more fans to, and therefore a little more money, do you think that it's a level of success that makes a band progress and find new avenues? Or is it just the person or the artist?
That's a really difficult question. I'd certainly know from experience in bands when I was younger, when it was people buying your record was literally the difference between touring or not touring. Mm. It's much harder to take those kind of risks because you're like your whole career or life as you know it at that point depends. Professional life depends on whether or not you make a successful record in your mind.
Yeah.
Of course it doesn't, right? Life goes on, it's just music, right? But at that time, it can certainly feel that way. These are the kind of pressures that create constraints that will never allow you to be creatively free.
Second albums.
Right? Oh, these, you know, and with our second album, it was hard because there's
ours,
two approaches.
No,
I don't think it was bad.
It wasn't bad.
But I think it was hard because you've been... You get a look at a particular life or existence or career, and suddenly it seems a little bit all or nothing if I don't build on this. This whole exciting world that I've just been stepped into for 5 minutes will be gone. Yeah. And if you allow yourself to get trapped in that...
That's the thing.
Right? And
it can
be.
Go away like
yeah.
That.
These are not unrealistic fears. This is the biggest part about it. You make the wrong decisions at the wrong time. The music business, all of the creative industries, you can be done so quickly. And blocking that stuff out is so important. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'll never make anything like artistically worthy.
But don't you think, when you look at like a long, you know, 20 or 30 years of something, I'm sure, sort of like what Matt was saying, everyone's had an album where they're like, well, everyone pack it up. I guess that was it. I guess it's all done. But then they continued, or they just tried something else, or they had a new collaboration, or they had a new spin on something. But they never would have arrived at that if they hadn't had this one experience that was, at the time, felt like a failure, but really was kind of a learning experience before a growth spurt.
Absolutely.
But that's very hard to remember when you feel like the walls are falling down.
Try telling that to someone who's trying to make a second album and be like,
I think in the long run, I think for me, of like bands that I love, like that feels more authentic. And Martin knows because I whine about it all the time. Like my number one bugbear about, like, I sound like an old, grumpy old man, but like about...
Just because you use the word bugbear.
Yes. Like a lot of contemporary music that's sold to you as if it's authentic is clearly not authentic. I'm like, well, don't sell it as that if it isn't that. That's fine. I have no problem with that. I love loads of like really intense candy pop stuff that's not necessarily coming from one certain place. Like there's all kinds of different things for all kinds of different reasons. But yeah, I just like the inauthenticity of it is the thing that kind of grinds me.
But that's also from the that's also a point of view that is representative of the eye of the person who's observing it, though, right? Because I'm sure there are some people who make bubblegum pop,
which I love,
which is fine. And some of them probably go, yeah, this is, it's just empty. It's like party music. This is what it's supposed to be. But I guarantee you, a percentage of them, and it's probably a high percentage of them, are like, no, I'm making a statement. I'm saying something that's really. But like if you asked them, they would probably think what they were doing was very authentic.
Well, and I think to me, I'm like, you can get huge stadium bubblegum pop that is really authentic to what that person believes and what they want to make and what they're trying to say. To me, that like the stuff that's more sinister is the stuff that's clearly been focus grouped within an inch of its life. This is not the kind of music this person would make.
Sure.
Somebody somewhere was like, this is how we pivot, and we're just going to rip off this band, this band, this band, this band.
Right.
And we're going to sell it as if you were the person that defined this genre. Mm-hmm. And like... I don't know. Like, I get it's just marketing.
You guys are in
the,
you guys
marketing.
Are kind of in that game, or not in that game, but you are in the swim with that the same kind of things more than we are. But I know what you mean. There's just like there are things that you there are formulas to being successful. Just like scientific audio formulas to be successful on the radio. Obviously, we've been learning about that. If you start to try to like chase that, then it's easy to try to chase that. What's much harder, what's really hard, I think, with to Lauren's part is that it's actually hard to be authentic. You know, it's meaning it's hard to actually be authentic with yourself.
Right.
Okay. So a lot of artists might be out there, you know, selling a record as it's a part of authentic part of themselves, but you can tell they're not. It doesn't sound authentic because you can tell they don't even believe themselves. They don't. Mm. They're lost.
A little bit.
So it's frankly it's very. I mean, I find it really hard to get a song to a place where I'm like, it's almost all the bullshit's out. You know. And it's okay to leave a little bit of bullshit in there because otherwise it's you know too hard to listen to it.
Right.
But it's hard. It's actually hard in yourself to put something, an emotion or an idea into words and then put it into a song, and get it down and get it recorded into it. It's really really hard. So that's why I'm so impressed when I hear any band like Churches, or there's lots of them out there that can. Big Thief is a band I can't stop listening to and stuff, and because it's you believe it. You just believe it.
Incredible.
Stevens, I believe, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
But I think go ahead, Laura.
Well, maybe that's why I'm just personalizing it too much. Maybe that's why those things bother me or something, because not bother me, but I don't know. I just remember being a 16-year-old girl that really believed certain things and like really loved these bands. And then
how feel like you years... want to talk about something.
No, I don't. I feel like I don't mean to like, because it's interesting. I had a conversation with our manager about it once, and he was like, "Yeah, but if it made you happy and you believed it, then why does it matter?" He was like, "It matters to you now as a person in a band. It doesn't matter to you as a person that loved those bands."
I wonder about that authenticity, though. It's if we look back at somebody, like if you know, you're talking about the algorithm that people have made of like how to make a successful radio song. I mean, the Motown did that. They had, you know, they would tell people, it's like, "Oh, start with the hook or start with the chorus, and then go into the rest of the song."
We'll bring in James Jamerson, and
it was like that Wrecking Crew idea of it's like, "Oh, what if we got the best person that we know that played bass, and we get this person?"
What was her name? The Wrecking Crew bassist. She was like, she was the best bass player, and she's like, she plays bass on every amazing, I think it's her. And yeah. It's nobody knows. That's a woman. You think of all these like session dudes. And
yeah, she was exactly. Like,
yeah,
it's an incredible documentary. We had the guy that directed it on here, I believe, on this podcast a while back. But it wasn't. That was something I listened to. Forget it.
Thanks for giving.
You listen to other podcasts?
He does. He doesn't listen to this one. He's never listened to this one. Not one time.
I don't know what my voice sounds like. I don't want to know.
I don't want to know.
But there is that thing. It's like, but we look back at those old songs, especially like a lot of Motown songs. Like, oh, look, you know, this is like authentic, or you know, that like old kind of rock and roll. Where people goes like, this was real music. Music was real back then, but it was almost more manufactured than what came after it. Mm-hmm. Which is, every time I think about, you know, there's those graphs you see sometimes of like, this is how many people wrote, you know, this Beyonce song, and it's a bunch of producers and stuff like that. And then this is how many people wrote Bohemian Rhapsody, and it's just like, you know, Freddie Mercury. And it's like people try to use that to discredit songs that are manufactured, but like you were kind of, what you were saying is that it's after it's made, it really, there's no such thing as bad music, because if a certain song connects with somebody and helps them kind of get happy or feel justified or, you know, feel, you know, better about themselves, then there's, it's hard to say like what's good and bad, because there was still someone that wrote down the lyrics, maybe they didn't necessarily felt it like in a real sense, but it was still in their head.
Yeah, like California girls, they really like, that's a really important message that people need.
Maybe she was
hear.
Saying that to her friend that was in a bad mood, and she said all these guys are leaving me for these New York girls.
Well, I genuinely believe, I mean, I don't know, I have this conversation with people or someone, and I'm like, I believe that Katy Perry means it. I believe that she will go down in history. I'm like, she brings a lot of joy to a lot of people. I've been to 2 Katy Perry shows and I cried both times, because like there was like dads that bring their daughters and she's singing Firework, and I'm like, I just can't with this, it's too much. But I genuinely, like, that's a great example, I think, of something that I'm like, well, this is a place that we don't come from, but I feel like she means that.
Yeah.
And that's
awesome. And that's the important thing, is meaning. Yeah. And what Matt was saying, I think, is the most challenging thing across any art form, is figuring out how to be authentic to yourself, because, number one, it's difficult to know who you are at any given moment. That's very difficult to know. And also, when you're kind of searching the far reaches of your emotional soul about who am I and what do I want and what does this thing mean to me, your emotions, because they're emotions, are very difficult to sort. So how do you know what is a real deep thing that you want to express and what is like but I also really want people to show up to shows because that feels good too. And I also, like, how do you sort through and really be authentic to the truest form of yourself? Because it's just going to get crowded and messy, and it's difficult to even know who you are at any given time.
It's so difficult. You just have to, like, the less time you spend thinking about it in that particular moment, in the moment of creation when you're writing, more so with music than it is with the lyrics. To be fair, I don't write lyrics in the band. Or lyrics take much longer, and you have to say what I want to say and all these questions. But with music, you just have to really invest in that particular moment where you write it for the first time, or you feel... everyone knows that feeling of, like, a new composition. The highest you ever get is the instant that it comes out, the moment where you surprise yourself or you do something.
There's that.
That just feels, like, special.
I just found something.
Yeah. That moment that feels special is, like, to me, anyway, is like, I don't know if you'll agree, it's the highest you ever feel. And then you spend all this time trying to get back to that moment. And we talked about this today, actually, with regarding the song we did. With Matt, if you can get back anywhere near that feeling at the end of the process, then it's to me, it's a victory. Like, it's, that's what authenticity is.
Yeah.
That you feel as strongly as you did at the end of months of recording.
That's a great way to put it. And I think
a lot of
people
go in and out of it, though.
Yeah. Oh, and you do. And there's days where you're like, this song is nah. And then there's days when you're right back there. And getting to that point with all of your output is, to me, the goal of making any record. And also reconciling the fact, this is the most important thing to me, people's relationship with music is not the same as my relationship with music. When I finally got over that some people don't care that much. They hear a song on the radio and they make one or two decisions. It's yes or no.
Yeah.
And they'll enjoy it for however long it lasts and then maybe never think about it again. Or you have someone like me who obsesses over records, obsesses over Radiohead, who thinks about a whole career, how a band is a gateway drug to whole genres of music you've never heard before. As soon as I figured out that not everyone was like that, I feel like I became a better musician.
Well, I remember you...
Because you're free!
I remember when you were on the podcast like 4 years ago... You said something very similar that, and it made me laugh really hard, where you go, yeah, it's something to the effect of, you spend so much time, like, pouring over the lyrics, but then people in the audience are like, just get to the, part. Because
that's the only one they can remember.
That's what they remember.
Yeah. And we have weird accents. We mumble. I don't know, but then to me, I'm like, it's all different parts of a process, you know? Like, I think if I didn't obsess over the lyrics, then I don't feel like it would mean a lot to me, and then I wouldn't perform it, and it wouldn't be communicating it right.
Right.
So, like, and there's some people that will obsess over every lyric in an inlay, and there are some people that are like, you know, people want different things from music. They want different things from any kind of art. So I'm like, after, we always talk about this, and like, after the record is out, it's like an exchange, you know? Like, it belongs to us in a certain way, but after that point, I'm like, it's not for us to tell people to prescribe how they should, if they can, like...
There was that thing on, was it on In Utero, when it came out, like in the liner notes, it's like they told you where to put your bass and treble on your stereo while listening to it. And I remember being like, don't tell me how to listen to this.
That's like musical omakase, where they're like, no soy sauce. Yeah. The chef says no soy sauce, and you're going to eat what we give you.
But so you turn the bass up really high, and then you're like, no, they're right, it does sound
good. God damn it, okay. I hate it when people are right.
How did they know there's... thousands of brands of stereos, right?
Yeah. What? Yeah. And they all sound different. There's not even numbers on the bass and treble. It's just a vague knob.
I don't know. So you just started pressing. Are people, I don't know why they're, I guess probably just because it's something that big that happened in music, but Dolores O'Riordan just...
Oh, yeah. God, that's just really sad.
Yeah, I mean, was there any... Have you heard any reason why or what happened? It was just
nothing
a very sudden, like, she just...
I have no idea.
Just died.
It's really horrendous. Awful for her family. It's really bad.
Yeah.
Do you, but no one, I just wonder, where I'm going with this is like, people go, oh, she was Irish, you're Scottish, you must have known each other. Like, oh, well, that's not the, we don't all, that's
no,
not
no,
how
I
all
don't
of
know
that,
anything about that.
Well, we did, there was a cab driver last night that was like, you guys, where are you from? You're Irish, you're Scottish, you know Calvin Harris? We were like,
No. He was playing the odds. Like, the odds are...
I was like, no, we don't, sir. But
do you know Belle or Sebastian? Either of them?
Either one.
Yeah.
Either one.
I do have, like, a really special relationship with the Cranberry song Dreams as a really small kid. Like, I think it is one of the first songs I ever really emotionally reacted to. I didn't understand what I was feeling. I didn't understand why it made me feel a particular way, but I was drawn to it. And I've never lost that with, you know, I've been able to understand it better. I went to music school and studied how exactly these things speak to people and what melodic relationships or melodic intervals make sense. But that feeling was the first time I ever felt anything like that. Was hugely important to me.
Yeah, I remember when the Cranberries got popular, I for like a half a second was a little snobby. I'm like, oh, it's like the Sundays.
Yeah.
And then I was like,
are you slagging the Sundays? I'm like, no, there's so much slagging on them. Slagging
away. No, I'm not slagging the Sundays anyway. I'm just like, no, I was saying, like, I loved the Sundays.
Right. But so you don't need two, yeah.
Yeah, but I was wrong, because I instantly was like, fuck.
Well, Cranberries are like they there was something a little more than just pop music.
Yeah. Mm.
There's something a little bit more like just the slipping into some of the gray area, emotional gray areas and stuff without any easy answers, or just like simple vignettes of a bad date or whatever, whatever the obvious, you know, tropes are. They kind of touched in more sensitive areas. And so when you hear that, even in the midst of all kinds of pop music, it sticks. Your brain's absorbing. You might not know the lyrics, but your brain is hearing words that are connecting and making you think about them subconsciously. And so that band had good writing in it. You know,
it's so good. Yeah, Linger still just like cuts me in half. Yeah.
It's funny to listen to even Dreams now and still enjoy that song, but understand so much better why I had that reaction to it, because there was something special melodically going on and lyrically, and something special in her voice. Things that you could hear a thousand songs and you don't react to them.
You can tell when someone... Yeah, it's exactly what you were saying before, that you can tell when someone gives a shit about what they're doing. And there are people who can fake it, but for the most part, it's just that stuff that's just a little extra sticky is the stuff where it's like, you know, maybe her voice went up in a certain way in a certain point because it had a specific meaning to her in that moment, and it's basically the recording and imprinting of that on you. You're just even if you couldn't say exactly why, like, I don't know, I just really like it. It's like that's connecting with something that's in your brain that is receiving whatever that is.
100%.
Yeah. But you just can't. I don't know. You can't fake that. I don't think you can fake that. I guess maybe a couple people can.
I have that relationship with the Cocteau Twins as well. I don't know if you guys like that band, but that's very similar. Like, such an unusual voice and an unusual style of guitar.
Heaven or Las Vegas.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my favorite albums of all time. Again, lyrically bizarre, and not, you only ever catch certain words because it's so stylized vocally. But I consider Liz Fraser to be one of the best ever in terms of vocals, and those records have the very same thing that you're talking about for me.
Yeah,
those little moments of inflection, those little pieces of things that just stick right in your brain, and they don't go away.
It's always stuff for me where a lot of times you listen to stuff and you can sort of see the matrix code behind it, and you go, okay, I see how they got from there to there, or I see you got from there to there. You know, I mean, a lot of time for me it's watching comedy, but it's when someone does something and you can't track it. You're like, how did they? Yeah. Then you kind of go, okay, that was some very special, unique thing that they were able to capture. And I understand, even if I don't relate to it necessarily, I can appreciate that somehow they were able to take this weird leap and it didn't fall apart. Yeah. Like, they were able to take the leap and rein it back in somehow and still be able to present it.
So true.
But you have to, I think you do have to, what Matt was saying earlier about, like, just sort of unplugging and pulling away and being able to, you do at some point have to live your life. You can't just make stuff all the time, right? I mean, you do have to fill up the thing that makes the thing.
I find the thing is, like, you, if you're not getting away from it when you're at it, you start to hate it because you're just like, I need to write something. And then if you go away from it for a couple of days, the minute you if you're somebody like my wife and I are both like, if we don't make something, if we don't get that thrill that like, oh, there's an idea, there's a seed of an idea, there's just a wisp of a fragment of a something that didn't exist before that's good, that should be followed, right? Like a blink of a light. They're like, that's some part that the Nick Cave describes as that little flame. Like, you gotta, if you see it, you gotta protect it. Mm-hmm. So if you're back to doing your thing and reconnecting and getting healthier again, drinking less, exercising, and then all of a sudden something sparks that little flame and you can't go back and get to it and record it, you start to get a little crazy, like an addict too. Yep. So the creative process is really weird and it's so satisfying. But if you don't have both of that, like, away from it, it doesn't want to pull you back. And if you're in it too close, it, you know, you start to hate it, you know. And it's a constant weird balance.
How much responsibility do you feel between – because obviously – the world is somewhat of a trash fire at the moment. So how much responsibility do you feel between giving people a show where you allow them to escape the trash fire versus feeling like, well, I have this platform and people listen to me and I feel like I do want to speak up for things that I care about? So what is your balance between talking about your like things that are very much a part of you, but then also commenting on things that you believe should be better in the world, but then also kind of reminding people like, hey, things are really shitty right now. Maybe people came out just to escape that, but I also want to let them know that they should be thinking about X, Y, or Z in terms of the world.
I think for us, it's kind of accidentally become a little bit of part of the DNA of the band, but it's kind of about finding the balance.
Sure.
Like, I realize that we are in a pop band or an indie band or however you want to look at it, and it's not, I understand how that can rub people the wrong way to feel like people are preaching at them. And at the end of the day, when we put on a show, I'm like, I do like the idea that it's like an hour and a half where people can just like escape from this and like project onto the music whatever it is they want in that time. It should be entertainment, but at the same time, like, a lot, no, we don't make political music necessarily, but like you put a lot of yourself into that, and I feel like lyrically, definitely I write about personal things but also personal perspectives on things, and I don't really see how you can live in this world right now and not write about, be affected by those things. It just wouldn't feel genuine. And like, if a record came out and it just didn't feel like it reflected anything that was happening in the world, I don't really understand how that would connect with people.
Sure.
But, and even like, I don't know, I guess that's kind of how we, I guess we met Matt and the National Guys through playing festivals, but then we got more, got to know each other better through this Planned Parenthood thing that Matt was organizing. And I feel like it's really exciting for us to meet people who want to talk about these things, because I feel like in this time, it's not even about party politics anymore in America or in the UK. It's about how you want to conduct yourself in the world. What kind of person do you want to be? And I think if we learned anything from that last election, it's like we don't communicate with each other. We can't. It's not as plain as one person's bad and one person's good. Like, we just like completely disconnected. Like, how nobody has, so few people have very much compassion or empathy. And how do you, I don't know how you make any kind of music or art in that circumstance and don't think about those things.
Right.
But maybe, I don't know. Not everybody would
feel
like that.
I think they do.
But,
you know, I really think that, I think that that stuff isn't dead. I just think that the form of communication that people use most of the time is a very impersonal form of communication. Just, you know, text and chat rooms and social media. And so because people are usually interfacing with text and machines, they're not interfacing with each other. So we're biologically not programmed to empathize with a device. So when people are like yelling through a machine, I think most of the time they're just not, their brains are literally not connecting that there's a human on the other side of this. Yeah. And that you're really, you know, and if you sat those two people in a room, you know, obviously a percentage of them would be like, nope, still fucking hate your guts. But I think they would, because of the way that our brains are wired, would try, look each other in the eye and start really trying to connect as people.
Yeah, I mean, it's like when you're in your car, you're more apt to just, you know, like scream at somebody from your car if they cut you off. But if like someone does that in front of you, you go, I'm sorry, it's okay.
I'm terrible in the car, but not in a way that I want other people to know about.
Oh.
Like, I don't,
gets real
I don't get up behind, I don't, get up next to people and like, I am down. I'm like, do you see what, you know, I'm not a bully in that way. But in the car, I'll be like,
you change.
It's just, I feel like a crazy elderly person in my car. What is this fucking like, genius doing? What the fuck? Oh, yeah. Okay, no turn signal. You know, like, it's a lot of that.
Like, Justin is genuinely one of the most kind, gentle humans I've ever met. And he is horrible person. Like, he's horrible. And I understand that Los Angeles traffic is bad, but like he once had a meltdown that was so severe in a car that he wasn't even yelling at me and I started crying.
Oh, no.
And then he was like, why are you crying? What's going on? I was like, there's so much like aggression inside this car, I can't. And he was like, but they were being assholes. They flipped me off. And I was like, yes, but this is not, I can't remember. So,
and then
yeah,
you learned a valuable lesson that day.
Well, he's
don't
gonna,
drive with you in the car.
Yeah, yeah, basically. It's like, I will just have to get a cab by myself. But, yeah.
I just take Ubers everywhere.
Well, what is it? Sorry.
No, you go.
I was watching talking about Nina Simone earlier, and I saw a YouTube clip. Was it you that sent this to me? Maybe it was.
Maybe. When was she talking about the big hat on?
Yeah, she has the big hat on, and then she's talking about how she was like, it's her job as an artist to take a snapshot of the world and like reflect what's happening in society. But she was like, but you also have the option of trying to shape that. If you have a tiny little platform to do it, then you are doing both jobs. I'm not saying that like art can change the world, but then I don't know.
And she suffered from talking about it. I mean, her career suffered from being as political as she was, but we're here talking about her, not the other ones that were, you know, doing similar. I mean, nobody was doing anything as close to what she was doing at the time. Mm-hmm. But the whole thing is like, I don't know how any artist. Obviously, we know there's some arts not. We don't want to be absorbing what we see in the New York Times and all that stuff. You're there to escape it, but all art is aware of it. Anybody writing anything, you're aware of what's going on in the world right now. So if it's not there in some sort of presence, if you just avoid it, you're just a totally like. Then I don't believe anything. I don't believe anything you're doing, because if you don't, I don't have to agree with you, but I want you to. If an artist isn't at least acknowledging that it's a trash fire or
right.
something, or that it's not necessarily on if their perspective that it's not, just we you know what's going on right now. I think that we're in a lot of trauma right now. It feels particularly traumatic, and I think young people are looking at this and just can't believe it. You know, just like what's, because this is the world that they're going to inherit, and so I do think there was a phase where it became uncool to be talk about, you know, politics or something in art or in music or whatever. And I don't know why. It's like Nick Cave, I don't think of him as a political artist, but he was digging into like, if you're talking about every love song is political, because you're if you treat that love song and the person in that song and both the good guy and the bad guy or whoever's side it is, you treat both sides with respect in the song, the characters, that's kind of political. Mm-hmm. So everything you write about is political, everything you do. So any artist that says like, I'd like to separate politics from art, it's kind of like, well, why don't you separate romance from art? Why don't you separate,
sure. mm-hmm.
you know, why take one of the most, you know, rich things to dig in, like the fate of the universe, right? Mm-hmm. And the relationship we have with every other creature on the planet and the planet itself. If you're not writing about that, what on earth are you writing about?
And also, like, because you will unlock, hopefully, whatever you make, if it's really good, it will sort of bypass all of the...
It's a reflection of all of that.
Yeah.
Even if it's just a love song or just a party song. Like LCD Sound System is a great... But they also reflect... They reflect a lot of, like, other real things, you know? And I don't think of you guys as music as remotely... I don't know, just heavy or anything like it, it's emotionally rich and filled with real stuff, and that's why you can listen to it more than 2-3 times,
right,
you
know? Right, right.
And that's why you'll probably talk about these guys, you know, in 20 years, you know.
Well,
and,
plus, yeah, when people are like, I just would rather not comment on those things, I'm like, sales. Every time I read that, somebody's like, I would rather not, like, in this moment, in this world, I'm like, we will look back on this no matter what happens, and we'll remember this time, and you'll remember what people did and what they said at the time. No, like, you're going to be remembered for your actions and your inactions. So, you know, going around being purposely silent, purposely silent about things. So what? So you can get, you can sell more units of a record that's already going to sell like way more. I'm like, this just seems irresponsible as a human being.
It is, but I have to say, there are times where like someone will say something, and I'll go, I can't believe that fucking guy said that. I'm going to fucking eviscerate that guy on Twitter. And then I don't, because I don't like conflict.
No.
And I know that every time I say something like that, it just makes people fight. And then I feel like I've just made people yell at each other. I'm like, fuck.
Right.
Well, I know it's not what I'm supposed to do.
I saw a thing in the news the other day about like Sarah Silverman talking. She responded to somebody on Twitter, but in a like really thoughtful, empathetic way. And she was actually trying to
help them out.
Yeah, help this person, and like, but also like listen to what they were saying and take on board their point of view. And I feel like at this point, because there's so much crazy stuff happening, like people on all sides are so quick to anger and blame other people, and you're not listening to anybody. Like, just because I don't necessarily understand where you're coming from doesn't mean what you're saying isn't valid. And
right.
like, we both watched the new Chappelle specials the other day, and there's a bit in it where he was like, there's never a settlement that ends in bloodshed that lasts. Like, that's never how this is going to go for anybody.
Right.
Like, no amount of blaming other people and pointing fingers is going to make either side happy once it's result.
And can we also just talk about how Dave just put out two specials like two
it just happened.
Yeah, he just like just put out
two specials right after he put out
two specials.
Yeah. Was, have you watched those? And the guys were like, we were like, but you just did that. And we're like, oh no.
No, there's two new ones. Yeah, there's two new ones probably on the heels of two more. Yeah, it's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
I think by the time this goes up, everything will be out.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yes.
I know.
So this is the future?
You know what I loved about your collaboration is it is the perfect... It is exactly... It's like, it starts out and you go, oh, it's a national song. Wait, there's the church part. Like, it is extracted the DNA from both and layered them in such a complementary way that it's almost like a fun chemistry experiment where you see, like, oh, if you could take this sound and smush them together, this is what that would be. It's really it's really great.
Oh.
Like, we were so excited when Matt actually agreed to do it, and then when we got the track back, it was just so cool because we'd lived with it for so long with me and Martin singing it, or like each of us trying different parts. And
who was singing it? Was it you?
Oh, that was me. Yeah,
You should release that one too, because I get kind of hooked to that version.
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is, you know, what we were talking about, that feeling of when you immediate that the flame, like you're talking about, of creativity. Hearing you on that song in the end, I was right back.
Yeah,
to the moment.
Maybe you could rehear what you'd written. Wrote it all.
I was there.
I was trying to do my
but
best.
Do you know when it came out? That very night, we were all saying, Matt. Matt's got a trip. We got to ask Matt to cut this.
Oh, cool.
Because it was so perfect, like, in my mind.
It's a great song.
I could imagine it so vividly. And then when we finished it, you're reminded of those... when your expectations are not only fulfilled, but exceeded. And what you brought to it is so special, in my opinion. And it's for everyone else to decide if it's good or not. And that's great.
We'll let
but
you
I was
decide.
So, yeah, I was so, like, emotionally connected to it again.
Yeah, and it was fun to kind of rehear it almost. Like, I knew those lyrics inside out and back to front, but then, like, hearing Matt sing them, it was just like they meant something different when they came from your storytelling angle. Mm. And I was
great lyrics. They were easy to believe in because they were believable.
So, I imagine, are you guys doing any shows together?
We should.
At this point in the past, we don't know.
We'll probably see each other at festivals.
Yeah.
You know what? Actually, there's a thing in Chicago. You were there the day before there. And so I might try to come early.
That is a great idea.
Well, who gets the...
Yeah.
Who performs it, though? Like, are you each allowed to perform it on the road? Or do you, like...
It's their song.
It's their song that you guess on. So
I guess we have the synths with us.
So but who sings Matt's part when you're on the road?
Hologram.
Oh, yeah. How are we...
It's gotta be you. It's gotta be Martin.
I feel like... God, this is controversial, but I'll just be like, it's one of those ones where... we don't touch it unless Matt is available. Like, I don't know.
I'd come on tour, but I heard about the guy with the pizza farts. Yeah.
Well, he's he moved on to other things.
Is he gone? All right.
He voluntarily moved on to other things. His pizza butt's gone elsewhere.
He took over Papa John's.
And look how that went.
I feel some responsibility towards the crew now.
There's
like,
not a lot
they eat
of
pizza
farters.
Every night. Like,
you can't make
I'm like, you can't live. Like, we come off the. We, and of course, you're working all the time and you're in a band and you're trying not to eat pizza every night. So you get on the bus, you smell pizza, you see it everywhere. All the crew guys are eating it. I can't help but feel jealous and guilty at the same time.
Worry for them.
I want the pizza gone.
Oh, you want it off.
But then,
so, you know what a crew would love is if you just set out like oats and nuts. What I find is that they love health food.
Right.
They love to not, they love to really, you know, just put out some dried apricots and
some
no beer
on the bus.
No beer, but we have raw broccoli.
I don't want to stereotype. You know, stereotype crew guys, because there's a lot of guys on there that do a lot of exercise and stuff. But I get that, like, load out pizza is totally the thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm like, nobody wants a load out salad. But then I'm like, they would maybe like the option of a load out salad.
Load out salad sounds gross.
It sounds rubbish.
It's
a sex thing.
Sounds like a gross sexual act. Yeah. I got a load out salad. Oh my God, you're lucky. How'd you?
That's Trump's America. No, you would probably say no to load out salads because. Like, no diversity of any kind.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless he's doing it and he's going to pay people off to say that he didn't.
Our crew was actually healthier than anybody in our band, I think. They're all like young moms and dads who are just taking care of them. They all do exercise and stuff together. Most of them have been with us for 10 years, so they've actually, our crew has been an incredibly good influence on us, just health-wise.
That's amazing.
Well, when we were shooting at midnight, I asked the craft, because we had craft service that was there all the time, and I said, you know, let's start making a healthy app, because they made amazing, like, you know, grilled cheeses where the mac and cheese was in the cheese, was part of the cheese. And I was like, you know, we should just offer, you know, offer some chicken breasts and vegetables and brown rice and that sort of thing. Never got touched. And so you really have to understand that loading in, like, what your crew does is
hard.
Miraculous.
Yeah.
To load in, set the show up perfectly so you can come in, do your thing, set everything up where it's supposed to go, sound the same. And then load it out the same night and do it again the next day. That you just fucking want a goddamn pizza because it's fucking good and you've worked really hard and it just feels good to eat a pizza.
That extends to music too.
Yeah.
Sometimes I just want to put on the fucking radio and sing to some shit song because I just want pizza.
I just talk myself into a pizza. I just talk myself into a pizza.
That's how I come to terms with, like, people's relationship with music. It's not like mine.
If they want the pizza, they should have the pizza. Plus, I always feel like... without those guys, we wouldn't be able to do anything that we're doing. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when we think about writer and stuff, I'm like, well, that's the crew's writer as well as our writer. So I'm like, do you guys want pizza? Do you want, like, some Nutri-Grain bars? What do you want? And then, like...
Okay, whatever you want.
They can choose, but then most of the time, they're at that point in the day, they just really want a greasy piece of pizza.
So let's just plug everything and every date that is in your head for anything that you want right now, now that we're sort of finishing up the podcast.
Here we go.
Wow. And this is going to come out after everything's already released, so you don't even say anything you want.
I have no idea of any of this.
What about plug any bands that you think should get more attention that you like that may not
be...
Well,
let them plug their thing first and then plug bands.
Yeah.
We're here to plug our own shit.
Yeah, come on, Jonah.
There's not enough room for everyone.
Fuck other bands.
Well, I guess, what are we doing? The record, I guess, at this point is out in the future, which is scary. And then we'll be playing some festivals in and around America and in and around Europe.
Fantastic.
In the summertime, and then potentially headline shows in the fall.
Great, man.
The thing I'll plug is the 7-inch for Planned Parent 7 inches for Planned Parenthood thing that these guys were the first. I reached out to a bunch of people right after Trump won, and the first three responses I got were like the next day. It was from these guys, Zach Galifianakis and Sarah Silverman. And getting them all to do this project is what got everybody else to do it. So it's called 7 Inches for Planned Parenthood. They have a brilliant song on it, and there's all this kind of Margaret Atwood's on it. And yeah, everything goes to Planned Parenthood, all the proceeds. Mm. And we're going to do another one, I think, for voting rights, not this year, which is terrible timing because it could be useful this year. But every other year, we're going to do a new compilation of it because it's turned out really great. And all these visual artists and stuff. So that's what I'm plugging, 7 inches for Planned Parenthood.
Great. Fantastic. And then any other bit? You mentioned Big Tribe?
Big Thief.
Big Thief.
Yeah.
Big Thief. Not familiar with Big Thief. Amazing. Now I'm going to go check it out.
Adrian Lineker is a singer. These guys, they've got a few albums out. There's a particularly a magical chemistry of honesty and brilliant songwriting and just a really powerful, just a great artist. Big Thief. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm someone's aunt. Did you listen to Big Tribe? It's Big Thief. I love the Big Tribe. Why do you keep saying that?
I think they're from Venice.
No. I don't know if I said this to you, Matt, the last time when we came to your house like 4 or 5 years ago or whenever we had you on the podcast, but that the song Exit Vilify that plays at the end of
Exile.
Radiohead was. I was thinking Exit Music for a film.
Yeah.
Exile, Vilify.
That song's also good.
It's also okay. That song's okay. But Exile, Vilify, at the end of Portal 2, is like one of the most powerful, because especially, it's just a great song by itself, but in context of what's happening. Did you play that game?
I never played that game. My brother loves that game.
God damn it.
I played that game.
It's fucking amazing.
It's incredible.
Portal 2 is one of the best and funniest and also most poignant stories in gaming.
I watched my brother play. He's a big gamer. He's teaching my 9-year-old daughter to play everything.
It's fantastic.
I'm a terrible parent. But my daughter and my brother are bonding, and they're having so much fun together. But so I'm happy that they're becoming good friends over video games. But I watched him play that game, and it's hysterical and kind of moving and creepy. And
it's really moving, especially at the end.
And yeah,
it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a song sort of like what you're talking about, where it's still just. That song just cuts through me, and the marriage of that to one of my most favorite gaming experiences of all time just makes me giddy, and so I throw some fan love at you.
Thank you.
But I love that. Thank you for coming, and thank you for including us in the charity show in December.
Yeah, thank you guys for doing it. Just so much kindness.
There's just so much fun. Well, here I thought, you know, I came into that show thinking like, okay, let's be extra, because the song that Mike and I did is in Spanish. We did El Corazon, so it's all in Spanish. And I didn't want anyone for a second to think that we were being derisive in any way, because one of the organizations was basically a home.
Oh, that, yeah.
Yes.
I didn't even think about that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so I didn't want anyone to go, oh, I get it, because it's in El Salvador, yes?
Nicaragua. So
it's in Nicaragua.
The Girls Home, which is a charity in Nicaragua for social orphans.
Yes.
And for No Kid Hungry.
Yes.
So those are the two things. But I feel like you nailed the mood of it.
Well, we did, you know, so we were extra careful to make sure people were like, this is very celebratory. We're now. And of course, David Koechner gets up and does $2 and a hand job as Naked Truck. I'm like, oh my god, we can do that?
Yeah, that was weird because I run for a bathroom break as that was happening, and I looked at the monitor downstairs and I was like, is Justin Pete? What's he doing? And I was like, and I kind of forgot that him and Dave Koechner know each other from like years and years ago.
Yeah.
From like waiting and stuff. I'd forgotten about that.
And maybe, yeah. And then they probably, I'm sure Justin must have gone to Largo shows when Koechner started doing Naked Trucker.
And I was like, whoa, they're really, really familiar with him. Is he okay being part of this bit? And I was like, oh no, he is. He's totally fine.
Justin was playing the game that was literally one of the first games that we ever played on at midnight that I borrowed from, like, was it Justin or I can't remember who our mutual friend was, but we have a mutual friend, and it's the movie titles that sound like pooping.
Oh, Poovies.
Yeah.
Poovies. Yes.
Was it called Poovies?
Poovies, yeah. Yeah, it's a problem.
Give me one example.
Like
The Longest Yard, anything that sounds like, yeah.
Yes, and it's great for all ages, a game for all ages, and yeah. Like car rides.
The Brown Bunny.
Dark Knight.
Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah. Oh, no. The Green Mile.
Any Which Way But Loose.
Yeah, Any Which Way But Loose is a fantastic one. Well played, Matt. Well played.
So, and I learned from that, I was like, how am I going to use that next time like something goes wrong in a venue, like the power's gone down and like the generator's not working? I'm like, well, now I know I can use Poovies rather than just quietly being like, so what are you guys up to? Are you okay? So.
Do you have it, John? Do you want to throw one in?
Eight and a half.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
8 Mile works, too.
Oh.
Mile,
yeah. I was trying to go artsy, I guess.
Yeah.
But then
48 hours.
But then it gets sort of, like, you can start stretching. You're like, Smokey and the Bandit? Maybe? I don't know.
I feel like once you're invested in the game, the more ridiculous, the better, yeah. I think. Like.
Jonah, you must have some more. Katie, you got to weigh in on this.
Phantom Thread.
Oh, no.
Mystic River.
Mystic River is a great one.
You say Brown Bunny?
I did say Brown Bunny. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it was Hodgman. That's who it was. That John Hodgman.
Ah, yes. See, because we're British, and we had a different Mac advert.
Oh.
It was Mitchell and Webb that did it.
Oh my God,
yeah.
They did?
Yeah. Yeah, so I didn't realize until I was standing next to him, and then someone was like, that guy. He gets a lot of that.
Oh, Justin, yeah.
He gets a little, hey, Die Hard! As he's walking around, I'm like, that's not for me.
How about Jeepers Creepers? How about Galaxy Quest?
Like, yeah, I'm like, come on, guys.
He's been in some of the...
I thought you were doing more movies.
Galaxy Quest is
Die Hard
Jeepers Creepers
probably
is pretty
a disgusting job. But yeah, so we didn't get those adverts, so I wonder if that allows me to look at him in a way that most of the American public don't.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Did you guys get Dumbo Drop? I can't stop now. Now it's just like, you just can't stop once you open it up.
Did you guys get Peep Show over here?
Yeah.
It was on Netflix for a while when it first came out here.
Right.
Yeah.
Those were a lot of YouTube watches early in the day.
That's great. And
That Mitchell and Webb look.
Oh, that's so good.
And Robert Webb's new book is really, really good, too. It's about like just growing up in toxic masculinity and coming to terms with it and some of that. It's called How Not to Be a Boy.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Very good. Yeah, yeah.
Interesting times that we live in.
It's really good.
Well, thank you all for being here, coming to the house.
For playing poobies,
playing poobies.
It's our pleasure, yeah.
You didn't give anyone points.
I don't do that anymore, Jonah.
You gotta go back.
That's over. It is weird to come out of talking about poobies with the way that we set up the podcast, which is enjoy your burrito.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.